You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
This is a podcast from comedianscomedian.com.
This is the Comedians Comedian Podcast.
Hello there, I'm Stuart Goldsmith, and today I'm talking to one of the nicest men in comedy, as well as one of the funniest. Here's Rob Rouse.
Let's talk about getting better, because you are someone who I have known for a long time. I've known your work for a long time. And the last time I saw you in Sheffield doing this story about your wife giving birth...
Yeah.
..was... I found you were comparing, and I was doing... I think I was just doing a set.
That was about a year ago, wasn't it?
Yeah. And I found you almost unfollowably good, and you were comparing. That story, that stuff that you were doing there was so good, I thought, bloody hell, what have you been taking? Do you know what I mean? Like, like the stuff of yours I was most familiar with before was stuff like your duck, you know, your pet duck kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And funny enough, I saw some of that online earlier in the week, and I was like, oh, I remember, the stuff with like the kids having a go at you going, what is that? And all the rest of it, it's lovely. But the stuff I saw about your wife giving birth was straight ahead of that stuff.
Oh, cheers.
Yeah, I mean, and not to insult the original stuff, which I thought was great. So do you feel that you've, like, I'm aware that I haven't seen you along that process, and it's always like when you see a kid and then you see them a couple of years later, oh, you've grown, you know, that sort of thing. That can be because you're... because one is observing it from sort of too far away. But I suppose what I'm asking is, it looks from the outside like something has happened to you that has taken it up several notches.
Yeah.
Do you feel that's true, or is that...
I think for me, like, and it's a personal thing, having a family was a profound moment in my life, and as I was having a second child, and it changed everything. It changed everything for me. It's like you've been handed a... For me, it's answered a lot more questions it's ever posed. I mean, and don't get me wrong, it's fucking hard doing this and having a family. But I think doing anything and having a family is fucking hard, but it's also fucking brilliant. That's what it is. And it's that balance, it's like being handed a big box of secrets. That's what it felt like for me.
It's
brilliant. It's brilliant, and it felt like life really, really, really opened up into widescreen, and the amplitude of the highs and lows just increases.
Okay,
like you open yourself up to a whole world of pain you couldn't, and fear and worry you couldn't possibly have envisaged beforehand.
Sure.
But at the same time, that is balanced out by the insane kind of level of joy and stuff that it brings, and that kind of, it gave me certainly a perspective on my life and everything else that I didn't have before, and I think I found that was the most useful thing. And also as well, I think I've been doing it 14 years, and it's only the last kind of 4 or 5 years I think I've got kind of any good at it.
Okay.
And obviously I made a living for 14 years, but I kind of, it's really weird. There was so much interest in me. In 98 when I did that So You Think the Funny Thing.
Oh, you won it, didn't you? You were an early winner, yeah.
And I was literally just throwing everything at the wall that I could think of in 7 minutes, 10 minutes. Mm. I look back at it and it made a lot of people laugh, but in reality, it was it was really new. I knew nothing. And I think it's interesting how the business or the industry, whatever, is inevitably is obsessed with what's new.
Of course.
But if I had the attention now that I had,
then,
man, it would, you know. But fuck knows, who knows?
Sure. I think a lot of people must think that.
But that's not to take away anything from anyone who's recently new and has got really kind of big in the big public sphere.
Sure.
Because they've had to step up and nail it every single chance they were given, you know.
Yeah.
So I always take my hat off to kind of, you know, people who've flown through fast because it's really, really, really hard. But yeah. But I certainly, it was funny, like, when, so, but I never looked, when got into stand-up thinking it was a career.
No.
And
one of the key changes, isn't it?
Yeah.
People that started 10 years ago or more.
Yeah.
Or 5 years ago or more.
Yeah, exactly. We were just kind of doing gigs, getting wrecked after getting stoned, eating loads of food and just really constantly just fucking about.
Yeah.
And we had no idea what it was, and it was just great fun. It just, and what was exciting was it, because I felt my life to that point, I started at 24, I rebelled late, and I trained as a teacher and all that kind of stuff, and then thought, I'm gonna stick it to the man at 24. Well, now I've got something to fall back on. and literally moved down to London with a suitcase and started doing stand-up, but because you couldn't do it anywhere else, there wasn't a circuit of these open spots, and literally got a job at Deutsche Bank working as a caretaker, seeing like the city from the ground up, which was fascinating. And just kind of,
well, the movies, it's Michael J. Fox, isn't it?
The yeah, totally. Oh, I love MJ, we love MJ. It's awesome, isn't it? I watched Back to the Future today. I love Michael J. Fox.
It's incredible, isn't it?
The way he moves, just kind of quick.
Yeah.
Really quick. There's an urgency about him. Everything's so big. But yeah, and so it never felt like it was a career. And then it sort of, after, so I think funny, I got a lot more gigs that, but I still think I would have got there anyway. And it was an accelerated moment.
So having had a lot of attention early on, what happened next for you?
Well, there was that whole thing of Karen Cohen, who was always amazingly supportive at the Gilded Balloon, it felt like everyone's going, right, so you're coming back next year with your hour.
Yeah.
And I thought, I've got 8 minutes.
Yeah.
You're joking. And so I kind of
and there was there less of a like an established thing now would be someone wins So You Think You're Funny.
Yeah.
And next year they come back on the Zone or as part of, they do a 20 as part of a package.
Yeah.
The year after that, do half an hour on the Free Fringe, maybe. You know, the year after that, they do an hour.
Yeah.
And there's a bit more of an established thing. Was that less established?
Well, it was kind of in place. And I did the Comedy Zone the next year.
Okay.
I compared it. But I came back with Ian Boldsworth and John Williams, and we did this show called Big and Daft.
Of course you did. I forgot about that completely.
Yeah, that built out of a night we used to run at the in North Finchley at the back room of a pub, and it was the stuff we did in between the sketches that became the kind of the thing.
Mm-hmm.
And we had these little puppets that came out at night, little Rob, little John, little Ian, who just used to talk about ladies and beer, and that was it. And they were kind of our little alter egos that popped out.
Okay.
And they were just car sponges cut in half.
Yeah.
And they would rip as we used them most nights, so they were always held together with gaffer tape. And so one night, you know, halfway through, it had been wrong. One of them would look really, really ill.
Yeah.
Very, very poorly.
And then another one would be brand new, and just, you know, yeah, it was real knockabout kind of and just daft fun. Silly stuff, and it felt kind of right to go back as a gang, as a team, right? Because I just didn't feel ready to do an hour on my own, and I didn't do that till after we'd done three Big and Daft shows, and then I went back in 2002, I think it was, okay. 2002-2003, and I think 2003 was a better show. And in hindsight, I still think, you know, when you're charging the public 10, 12 quid to come and see you, like, kind of, it's a lot of money. It's a lot. I mean, it was back then as well, you know. And I think, I don't know, who's to say, but hindsight, I don't know, it's weird, isn't it? I still think I just did it too early, I think. And then when I went back in 2000...
You did your hour too.
I think, yeah, I did two. And then I think when I went back in 2009 and did the first one, It was called My Family and the Dog That Scared Jesus, which was about having our son and this randy dog. That was, that happened. I went back then because I thought, I've got a story to, this is a big, big lump of stand-up that, that works.
So that was the beginning of your sort of renaissance, was it? In the 2009
was the beginning
of you going, right, so. Here I am as a finished article.
Yeah. And yeah. I think what it boils down to is, it's funny, because I was a really late bloomer at school, classic kind of comedian, didn't grow quite late, voice broke late, all that kind of shit. Mm. You come back after every summer holiday, fuck, his voice is broken, it's unbelievable. And it was just terrible. And so obviously, kind of, I never got into trouble. I always knew when to kind of hold back. So it's kind of knowing, not thinking about it, but you sort of know where the line is to a degree, and then you can hop across it and you can hop back. And then, when I started doing stand-up, I was influenced by lots of stuff, because it's hard to grow up as a teenager in Britain at that time, you know, and not be confronted with so much brilliant comedy. We're really lucky. And then, but I didn't know who I was. That was the bottom line of it. I was still a boy. Yeah. I was a 24-year-old boy. I didn't have a fucking clue who I was, what was going on. I didn't really know who I was. Yeah, that was it. And then having kids kind of, I suddenly had a role.
Yeah.
But before that, I suppose I had quite a lot of kind of TV exposure and, you know, Friday Night Project and other stuff that felt like it was, something was really accelerating again.
Sure.
Or taking off, and then the kind of that went away, they cleared the decks, and then Justin Allen went on and did like 6-7 series of that. And I'd be lying if I said there wasn't a bit of me kind of thought, well, that's waving the millionaire boat goodbye.
Yeah, sure.
And, Jimmy's
sure.
on that one. Off goes Jim.
See, yeah,
Jim,
sure, bye. Sure.
But then again,
do you have a sense of why that was? Do you feel like you were overlooked for a particular reason because you didn't have an angle or a voice, or you weren't being yourself?
Who knows? I haven't the faintest idea. But then when I look back at it, I can think, right, well, I mean, Jimmy was...
So I think we might be assuming a bit on the part of the listeners.
Oh, yeah.
So let's just explain what that was.
That's fine. It was Jimmy Carr, me and Sharon Horgan.
Yes.
And a celebrity guest.
Gotcha.
And I think ultimately, probably they probably had too many people on it. But we did one series and then... But I think, yeah, look back at, like, Jimmy was the year below me at school, effectively.
Okay.
In stand-up.
Yeah, yeah.
But we were all getting wrecked, right, and kind of having fun and doing stuff. And Jimmy would do his gig, nail it, with his clipboard, then go home, then rewrite them.
Yeah.
And come back the next night, whatever gig he did, kind of 50% better, or whatever it was. Yeah. And by the time, we probably go, God, how's he getting so good so quick?
Yeah, sure.
He's actually working on it.
He's actually
fucking working hard, you know, he's doing it. But everyone's different, and I think now, it's funny, now it feels like there's maybe more of a template that people might think there is for getting into comedy when they come and do it.
Yes.
But there isn't, that's the point, there isn't. There's just your life.
Sure.
And the longer I do it, the more I realise... I don't think it's a career. I think it's an illness.
Yeah,
it's a terminal illness. Okay. Being a comic, it's a compulsion. That's how I sum it up. Because you'd make try and make people joke if you mended photocopiers or whatever, but you've found a job that enables you to spout off, to spew out, and the worst case scenario as a comic, if you keep writing, is you'll be in the corner of a pub somewhere screaming at strangers and getting paid for it, and then going home and you'll have got it out.
I love talking to Rob. He's such a nice man. He's so enthusiastic and energetic, and I'm really impressed with how he's managed to wrest back control of his life after his career taking off threatened to destabilise a lot of things for him. He writes, his comedy writing is almost exclusively about his life, and we discuss how he does that, and also how he writes without any formula, but nonetheless comes up with really strong, gimmick-free stand-up. I sometimes worry that being a comedian and having a happy family life
seem to be mutually exclusive, but I think here Rob proves me wrong. So we're going to talk about the way Rob's family has changed the kind of comedian he is, as well as the kind of man. Just a couple of little things before we get stuck back in. The winner of the last Funny for No Money, which was months ago now, I can only apologise. The winner was, what you had to do was combine the concepts of comedy and geography. The winner was Bloody Helm on Twitter with geography, which probably gives you some idea of the standard. So the next one, tweet with the hashtag Funny for No Money with your ideas for the title of a comedy show that combines gardening and music. I'm trying to make it easy for you. Go wild. I'm not going to start you off because I've got to go and catch a train. But gardening and music with the hashtag Funny for No Money, a show title that combines those two concepts. And if you've ever been paid for comedy, your hashtag is Hack for Cash. Get stuck into that. Nothing else to say here. Thank you for listening. Thanks for all your support. I do keep emailing me. It's info@comedianscomedian.com. I read all your correspondence. I will get back to it eventually, I promise. Join the Facebook group if you like. Tweet me at ComComPod and send in your suggestions for guests, particularly Australian and New Zealand comics or comics from anywhere in the world that you know are going to be at Adelaide, Melbourne or New Zealand festivals over the next few months, because that's where I'm going to be. Now, back to Rob Rouse.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
There is no right and wrong way to do it. I think if for anyone who's listening to this who's started, and I don't think you should think you have to follow any particular career path, because there's a little bit of me as well that kind of thinks like we're never meant to, as comics, we were never meant to be part of the establishment or kind of you know, we were never meant to be. Oh, are we meant to be at the Royal Variety Performance? Oh, sure. I don't know. There's no right or wrong.
It does start to feel more like the pre-alternative comedy.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? That alternative comedy wasn't supposed to be at the Royal Variety show.
Yeah. And now we all are.
So does that mean that we're alternative anymore? And it starts
really weird,
not to, doesn't it?
It starts not to.
It's like, it is a little bit like kind of punks growing up and kind of, the Who doing Royal Command performances.
That's right,
and you
go,
well, has this thing ossified? What we're kind of celebrating here is the energy and anger and struggle, none of which is necessarily in your life or in experiences anymore.
Yeah. It's really strange, isn't it?
It's very weird.
So are we actually leaving a massive open goal for a new movement to just kind of go and tear it all down and go, well, fuck that, we're not doing the Royal Variety Performance.
Sure.
And you're all dead and all the kids will go, hang on.
Well, I'm certain that is happening. I know that's happening at the moment with some of the weirder acts that I've seen, the more alternative kind of acts.
But I think that's what it's funny. I think just... If you're doing something that is this complicated and intricate and hard and fun and fucking amazing, isn't it, to do, you don't want it to become boring, you don't, or become square or kind of.
Do you want it to become work? Let's talk about the relationship between the work and whether or not it's work. Because I'm just thinking about, in terms of what you say about Jimmy working, like Jimmy Carr coming in working really hard when you were in a position where you were sort of thinking, I'm partying now because I'm on telly and it's great fun and we're all having a laugh, let's enjoy it. And he was thinking, I mean, not only did he have a sort of a business plan, we imagine, but he also had a template, he had a work ethic. He had a, this is a job, I'm approaching it like a job.
Yeah.
And I certainly, I can see amongst my peers and the people who were my year at school that some people treat it like Sarah Millican, this is a job, I'm going to treat this like a job of work.
Yeah.
Not to connote any kind of mundane approach to it at all, but she tore into it going, God, yes!
Absolutely.
Like a train.
Absolutely.
And then there's people, sometimes I feel like that,
yeah.
And other times I feel like, no, I'm doing this. I remember talking to Rex Boyd
in, yeah. In a dressing room. Rex Boyd, for the listener, is a comic who's actually, I think he's completed comedy. He stopped doing it now and works somewhere else. But he was an ex-street performer. Mm. And I remember talking to him in a dressing room in Western Supermare, the yep. Joker Western Supermare. Yep. And he was saying, I could put lots more work into my comedy mm. stuff. I could spend more hours of the day writing and administrating and doing all that stuff. But I did this job so that I wouldn't have to do that.
Yeah.
I did this job because it's fun, because I don't want to spend my life working.
Yeah.
So I think if we look at those two poles,
yeah.
Jimmy Carr on one side, and I'm not saying Rex specifically, but, you know, coming from a background of street performance yeah. myself, the whole point was it was a DOS. Mm. The whole point was we can make an easy living. You know, we can have fun, we can make people feel good about themselves, yeah. and we don't need to work many hours in the day.
Yeah.
And everyone has to decide where on that spectrum mm. are they putting it. And I think the thing is now, the rewards are so great mm. that a lot of newer acts are saying, well, I'm definitely going to be on the Jimmy end of the spectrum.
Mm. But you see, also at the time, no one else was like Jimmy. Jimmy was punk.
Sure.
Yeah. he was punk. He was a suit punk.
Yeah.
Because he was completely different. He was completely yeah. different. He was absolutely unique. And again, someone like Sarah, she's come into it and she's... They've approached it in a mature manner. It's interesting. They both had quite considerable lives and careers before they started doing stand-up.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So they came to it as quite grown people, didn't they?
Sure.
Whereas I started as someone who didn't know who they were.
Yeah.
And you grow up in front of audiences with your trousers around your ankles. That's the yeah. amazing thing about stand-up, isn't it? You can't practice in front of a mirror. You've got sure. to do it with your kecks around your shoes. But yeah, so I think, and then so I had my kind of that little switch on for me was maybe having a family, because then I kind of yeah. it sort of upped the stakes, and also it unlocked a lot of repressed emotions in me, I think.
Okay.
Yeah, maybe.
Go
yeah,
on.
Yeah.
With specifically what?
Well, I think just I wore my heart on my sleeve more as a result of it. And
yes,
and,
okay.
And when I went up to do that show in Edinburgh, that first one, I don't read reviews now. I did that year, and it did seem to just split people down the line of going, this is great because he's talking about stuff that matters to him, mm. and then other reviews that said, oh, it's about kids. Heard it.
Yeah, sure.
You know, and everyone's entitled to their opinion, and you have to accept that there's a rainbow of opinion about everything that everyone does, isn't there? Mm. But I kind of thought that I knew that because it mattered to me, I could put into it what it needed to perform it properly, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you can, and I think, and now I'm drawn towards, I certainly was in this last tour, a kind of a deeper level of all of that stuff. Of it's the fact that life isn't pretty. And it isn't comfortable. It's brilliant. It's great, but the stuff that people think they don't want to be laughing at when they come in is really the stuff that you should try and make
that
them
they
laugh
need
at.
To be laughing at. Yeah.
But not by bullying people or just trying to be extreme or obscene about something or shock people.
Mm-hmm.
I get a lot of. I mean, there was about 35-40 minutes purely about poo.
Yeah.
In that show.
Yeah.
That I think was some of the best stand up I've ever written, not just about poo, Stuart, but just some of the best stuff I've done.
Yeah,
because you can see at the start of it, people are going, "Oh fuck, he's talking about poo."
Yeah.
Oh, don't talk about poo. And by the end of it, they're going, don't talk about poo. and I think it felt like a real taboo with an audience. Mm. We can't talk about poo.
Sure.
But he's just fucking had one. Where's your hang-up come from? Why are you ashamed of something that is going to come out of your bum every single day? It's really weird. And yeah. on one level, it's really childish and really basic and really base. But on another level, I think there's something quite interesting about the things that that people will recoil from.
And pretend aren't happening.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And where the fuck has that shame come from? I blame the Victorians for so many things. And it's like everything. It's like the fact that, you know, there's so many things that we just carry on unquestioned in our lives. Like the fact that kids go to school at four. My boy's at four. He's at school.
Mm.
It's fucking ridiculous. He shouldn't be at school. It's four. He's learned to queue up now for the rest of his life. It's weird, isn't it? It's like, okay. Lots of that stuff.
Okay. So that stuff, in terms of that material, that sounds to me like it's coming from a place of actually wanting to say something, actually wanting to express something, like getting your teeth into a subject, which might be a bit different to the stuff about your pet duck.
Yeah.
Which was funny stuff.
Yeah.
But it wasn't really about anything other than...
But there's an interesting... When I look back at it, there's an interesting beginning of the seed there, that the duck... For me and Helen, my now wife, was our first surrogate baby.
Okay.
Because it was a duck that lived in the flat and wore a nappy.
Okay.
And we invested a lot of love into this duck.
Yeah.
And we would cuddle it twice a year. It would come into season and despise my wife.
Yeah,
and we
really?
Literally was prepared to fight her to the fucking death. I came back one afternoon and Helen was backed up onto the kitchen sink with a duck just... She was bitter in the lip, all sorts of stuff.
Oh my god!
Yeah, she just turned on a sixpence twice a season because you know she wanted the Drake. I just but
potential,
that never happened.
Potential show title: Rob Rouse, the Drake.
Yeah, just in a little green collar. But that never happened. I never fucked the duck. Okay. But
did you see what I mean in terms of the material itself? And do you think that happened at the same time as you becoming a father and relishing a different role in the world?
You
was like, I want to say stuff now, or
I think it's just that I had something that I was investing in outside of travelling to gigs, going on trains, going on planes, going in hotels, all that kind of stuff, and the business and everything.
Yeah,
I started talking about things that I was passionate about, and I thought, you know what, I don't want to be telling everyone how I think the world is, because I've not worked that out.
Sure.
And I don't feel confident to do that. I'm not confident in my opinion in what's right or wrong, how people should or shouldn't live their lives.
Sure.
So I'm not that person. But here's stuff that I have a lot of fun with, that is a world that I get lost in, that is me.
Yeah.
And I'm going out on a bit of a limb by doing it, and it's funny, because I remember I was doing a TV warm-up the afternoon, the duck got killed in this very garden we're overlooking.
And I'd
just been inside to make a cup of tea, came out and she was dead, blood everywhere. The fox that had just killed her was coming back to take it, and I scared him off. And I would just stagger around the garden. And he also took the chicken, Mrs. Miyagi, took her down as well. And I rang the producer I was doing the warm up for the afternoon, and said that the duck's just been killed. And she went, "Oh, sweetheart, I'm so sorry for you. I'm so sorry for you. Just come in next week. Just leave it. Don't worry. We'll get it covered." Oh, fuck. And then I got there the next week, and it was a warm-up for 8 out of 10 cats. And they were all going, "Are you okay?" Frankie Boy went, "I heard about the dog, man." And it was a bit... It was because I talked about it so much.
The people's duck.
Yeah, and
it was the duck of our
exactly,
hearts.
Exactly. I made 10 short films with the duck. The duck films. And all that stuff. And... it was mad, and then we got a dog. It's our little story, isn't it? We got a dog, and a puppy from Battersea, and then all that came along with him and his proclivities and stuff, and that started becoming what I talked about on stage.
Yeah,
and then we, you know, fell pregnant with Ellen fell pregnant with our son, so I started talking about that. So I find it easier for me to talk about what's under my nose and just try and express my feelings, and I don't have any answers, and my confusions and all the stuff that brings up. I think it feels like I'm more involved in the world than I was by dint of those things, because we all came from a place, we're all going to a place, the ground, and we were all born, and we're all part of that thing.
So I
don't know, so it's potential. I've heard Eddie Izzard talk about a thing called the mother load.
Yes, I've heard.
That was a phrase. I'm not quite sure how to use it yet.
Yeah.
But I like the word. But it feels like
it's a thing you tap into. You find out what your thing is that you tap into, and you go, right, I can now spend my time tapping into this thing, rather than casting about in the wilderness, which I think I spend a lot of time doing.
Yeah.
I think we all go through a phase of going, what is it? What can I say that will be funny? How can I get the results I want?
Yes.
And then when you find the thing, you go, now this is... It's not just a case of finding... a thing to talk about that's funny. It's finding the way that you are funny.
Yes, but you find, you think you found the thing, and the thing is good for a bit, and then you change because the thing changed you, and then you have to change again and find the new bit of the thing. But I think that's what it was. I mean, do you know what I mean?
I'm just thinking from the point of view of listening to this again further down the line. We're both articulating this very badly, but I think it's a really good point.
It's all about things.
It does. I've not considered that before. It does. You find it and it changes you.
Yeah.
And you have to find another one. You have to find it again.
Yes, because life is fluid and life is constantly... we're all living in this one moment... And you can never lock yourself down, or at least I can't, and go, right, that's who I am. So that's the thing I do, that's how it comes out, that's my formula. I don't have a formula, I'd have no idea.
Let's talk about the writing. If you don't have a formula, have you been through various attempts at formulas? Were you trying to crack it? How do you write stuff? How did you write stuff when you started? How do you write stuff now?
Well, I think...
that question couldn't be any bigger. Let's zero in on a bit of it.
When I started, I would literally just bolt together as many just non sequiturs and madness and extreme things as I could.
Okay.
And then just rattle through them at a breakneck speed with immense energy and hyperactivity that was all fueled by utter fear.
Okay.
That's what it was, and terror.
Fear of what? Fear that they wouldn't laugh.
Fuck it up, not getting it. Just the terror of 400 people staring at you, wanting to, like, just a simple visceral reaction that most human beings would have in that situation.
With 400 pairs of eyes.
Yeah. Just the genuine shit your pants terror of what that really weird position that you put yourself in is. I think that's what it was. It's like two phases. I would think that it felt like, I still get it now, that when you do interviews for like the tour and stuff, because they go off old things and Wikipedia and all that kind of stuff, and go, hey, known for his hyperactive brand of really upbeat, blah, blah, blah.
Sure,
and you just go, oh, fuck, I've not even slept at all last night, and I'm covered in baby sick, and I'm the hyperactive guy.
Sure.
And you're not. And then, so it's come in two phases. There was that where I felt, and it felt weird, like there was an expectation that I was the guy who was always happy, always upbeat, classic Tears of a Clown kind of thing, territory to stretch yourself out into emotionally, that I would always be, you know, I would always be Mr. Sunshine. And so then there was a pressure to kind of put that on to do gigs. And what I found more about talking about what's under my nose is however I'm feeling, that can just start where you are. That's how I look at it now.
Okay.
So if I'm feeling completely fucked, I'll write a piece about being completely fucked. And then that's what I'll try and work on. And then when you get to performing it, you've been there, you know what that emotion, that feeling is, and you can tap into it because you probably had it the last couple of days. And I got a brilliant bit of advice just sort of a point when I started writing stuff about my stuff and the dog and everything. That around that time I was working with Raymond Meehan's, the Scottish guy from Glasgow.
Yeah, okay, I don't think I've encountered.
And I had a bunch of kind of jongleurs gigs in Glasgow with him that went well. Because I love gigging in Glasgow. It's brilliant. Yeah. It's an awesome city, isn't it? If they like you, they really, really get into it. It's just an emotional. Like, you talk to people who play in bands, they hit one note, everyone hits the floor. They want it to be good. They won't bullshit you, but it, you know, they bring the fun. They bring the party. Mm-hmm. But Raymond Meehan's gave me the best tip I've ever had from any stand-up, which was, he said, if you're telling stories, he said, what I try and do is I picture it in my head and literally look at it, and then I tell the audience what I'm looking at.
Okay.
And try and explain to the audience what I'm seeing.
Okay.
And it's a really good way of just, because if you're telling stories and big moments and things that happen, it forces you in the moment, I find, really try and describe it when you're
course,
in the pocket.
That's so obvious, God.
To actually realise where the audience is and where you are in the story, where they are, where their expectation is, and it makes it easier to kind of give them the right bit at the right moment.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean?
Sure.
Kind of to pop the bubble at the right point and find another superlative or adjective or that, that just fits that moment, I think. Sure. I think then that's, and that's part of the excitement of doing stuff, I think, that's personal, is you've got to live it out as you do it. You can't just read it off the back of your eyes, and that, so that enables you to, I don't know, access something that's it's coming out of your guts, hopefully. That's when it really works, that's what it feels like. It feels like it's just coming, it's coming out, I think, and I find that really satisfying. It's weird, and at the end of a gig like that, I don't feel high or I just feel really, really calm.
Shriven.
just really, really at peace and fine.
Yeah.
Before, I was doing it in a very different way, and it was a lot more, and it was much more nervous. Now,
okay.
I feel like I kind of still get nervous before every gig. That's kind of, I think that's normal, but I kind of, I don't know, it feels like a more natural thing to do now, if that makes any sense.
So how is that different, the feeling when you come off, to how you used to come off stage after doing hyperactive?
Yeah, I used to drink, you know? I used to smoke and just go, just had to burn that off somehow. And now it might just be age as well. I feel I can go and have a beer, or I could just go and do something else, or just relax.
Because you said what you needed to say.
Yeah, talk to friends if they're there, or you know, just talk to people I don't know, but just happily just chatting to them.
Yeah,
without any need. Without any need to kind of feel I need to further entertain.
Still be performing. Yeah. That's great. Well, that sounds like maybe not just age, but that sounds like a maturity of you as a performer as well. That you are actually getting that stuff out on stage. You're saying what needs to be said.
Yeah, and I don't think it needs to change anyone's lives or anything like that. It needs to really make them laugh.
Something I really noticed about your stuff when I was kind of revising you this week. I was kind of watching the few bits that are on YouTube. Is that your stuff is really gimmick free? You don't have any. Difficult to describe, and I think in a good way, it's stand-up comedy. Do you know what I mean? You're not kind of hitting familiar notes. You're not sort of stuck in one attitude.
Mm-hmm.
It's storytelling. It's really infused, really evocative storytelling, and very fast. And there's loads of punchlines in it, loads of kind of changes of tack and changes of perspective and things like that. But there's nothing formulaic about it.
Oh, cool. Thank you.
Yeah, well, I think that's fair to say. So in what I'm asking is in the creation of the stuff, I mean, do you sit down and write it?
Nothing. There might be a point when I try and write bits out longhand just to straighten them out if I feel I've got a bit knotted up.
But mostly you're doing it from memory each night.
Yeah, and tape gigs. And there's notes. I mean, I've got gallons of them in my bag that are just literally, they're like lace that I just scribble on top of scribble in different coloured biros and keep them in my back pocket, where they kind of mature, they rise like a dough. And then some of them get stuck to each other through bum sweat from gigs, and then they're rendered useless. But maybe one day I'll peel them apart with a pair of tweezers and then write on the top of that, but it's generally, they're generally just bullet points. Okay. Reminders, say that or bring in,
because you're creating the stuff on stage.
Walking
on with a thought and going, right, I'm going to see the picture in my head, I'm going to describe what it is, and then that's the bit.
That's how I do it now. If I do new material nights, or when I'm comparing, I try and come away from every comparing weekend with a new bit, a new thing. So I have to, otherwise what's the point, I kind of think.
Sure.
And I think the circuit, I love the circuit, and I think I just want to use the circuit each year to write a show in.
So when I was distracted there because I was looking at your next question, but I think that's a really healthy way to view the circuit.
Yeah.
Is using the circuit to write a show.
Yeah, I mean, it's great fun. You can earn a living, and if you keep your wits about you, you can write. You can write. You shouldn't have to think, fuck, Edinburgh's coming up in 3 months, we've got to plough it together in previews.
Sure.
Because why not just keep just firing bits in each night? I mean, you can't do it all the time. There's nights when you just have to hole up or go, right, there's 60 soldiers in, we need to get on with this.
Yeah.
But I think just see it's an opportunity, the circuit, to just develop what you do all the time, I think.
So let's address a specific thing, just in terms of how you create the stuff. I've got a phrase that I wrote down when you're talking about having your kid walk around the house like a billionaire.
Yes.
Yeah?
Yeah.
So it's a lovely idea, and that's, I've heard lots of different varieties of what it's like having a kid.
Yes.
That seems really fresh, really interesting, really funny. And you said, one of the lines is, he's just having a wee in the room like a businessman having a piss against a tree on a golf course.
That's right, yeah. So, he's got a paunch.
Yeah.
Like a paunchy businessman having a piss behind a tree on the ninth hole or whatever it is.
Yeah,
comes out different ways, different nights. Yeah.
Well, that's what I was going to ask. Yeah. It comes out different ways in different nights. So you haven't sat down and written that line and took out the unnecessary words and tried to find the right thing. You've just said it over and over again, differently every time, and it still comes out differently every time.
Yeah, I tape a lot of stuff and listen to it back when I can, but so many gigs I tape and don't listen to.
Yeah, well, that's, I think that's endemic.
That comes up again. Podcast cliche, isn't it? Classic. Ding, ring the bell. Things mature and then sometimes they grow and they get extra kind of branches and leaves on them. Other times that shrinks back and there's a dieback in the season and it becomes just a nut again or an acorn, and you might plant that in another idea or a show and it grows into a completely different bush.
Because
life is fluid, isn't it?
Yes.
If you're talking about life.
I do that, and I've always had a go at myself for doing it. I'm like, oh, I can't believe I'm putting in that old bit from a thing. And actually, that's exactly what I'm doing. That's a much more healthy way to think of that.
Why not? Yeah, I mean, if you're releasing them as shows or DVDs, you want to make sure there's no, you're not crossing things over.
Sure.
But it can often be a way, it's like spider plants. It's a way of growing another bit, is you just,
I don't know anything about spider plants, but in the use of the analogy here, I think
in the 80s, those pot plants you get for 50p at boot sale, and then a little plant would come out on a stick, and then that would grow.
Okay, gotcha.
Well, like one of them, them cake plant. Tastes awful, but they keep providing cake. But that's the banana. You know, your comedies taste awful. But I did. But also as well, kind of at the end of the day, fuck it. Why have any rules? Why should there be rules? Like all of it, like.
Come on, squares, stop having rules.
It's a job, isn't it? It's not a job. It's a thing. It's a journey. It's a fucking illness. It's a compulsion. It's all of that stuff.
Yeah.
I remember I used to watch my sister, like she was she did like textiles she designing stuff. It was hard to describe because what you're doing is I'm just doing, just designing things. And then she'd do something, then just pull it out and do another one, and it was fun. Something was happening.
Okay.
But she couldn't describe what it was, and I think in a way stand up can be like that. You can be crafted if you're looking at stuff you want to be able to look all the way around.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't write like Bloomy does. I don't write. Yeah. My brain doesn't work in that way. It's phenomenal how Adam writes, isn't it? Brilliant.
Sure.
Amazing. I work by chucking stuff at things, and then squidging it. I've heard the analogy of moulding clay or other time it just comes out different each time, I think, but then what does remain the same, it's working it up in front of people.
What would scare me about doing that, because I'm a bit I'm more precious than that. If I get a thing that works, I sometimes think waste a lot of time and worry on trying to say it exactly the same way as it got a laugh last time.
Yeah.
And I think that's to my detriment. I think that holds me back. But I think I do that because I'm scared that if I say it slightly differently, I'm expecting it to get a laugh, it might not. So do you have confidence in yourself that you're funny, or is it confidence in the concept is funny, or do you just trust yourself that however you say it, it'll work?
It's a bit of all of those things, isn't it? I think sometimes when you go into your gig that I feel in the pocket. I feel I'm alive. I'm saying hello to people. I'm chatting to the guy at the coat check and all that kind of stuff. And you feel connected to humankind sometimes. You just feel right. It's happening. And then other times you have to find your way into the day. It's like life, isn't it? It's hard. It's always a little bit different every time. You can never completely read an audience. They're always going to surprise you. They're always going to be a bit different, and they're always going to laugh slightly differently at different bits. But when you've done thousands of gigs, you just get used to you play the people who are laughing, not the people who aren't laughing.
Yeah,
do you know what I mean? There's lots of things like that that you make it work rather than looking for ways to trip it up. We did the Friday Night Project, and then I did Spoons, and another thing, I did a sitcom on BBC Three called Grown Ups, and then sort of kind of a lot of that's the TV side of things just kind of seemed to just die off,
died away,
and I had to deal with it. I'm stuttering now because we're getting into some shit here.
Yeah,
so. Yeah, and I would be an absolute liar if I didn't say that dealing with that was, because inevitably you see things and you start getting money and you know you're able to kind of buy a flat and it's like this is now whoa, what's happening here, and you want to look down or you don't want to, you know, get a speed wobble going,
and then
it felt like, you know, but it's small time concerns in the grand scheme of life and the world and what everyone deals with. And then all that stuff changed, and it just sort of just gradually kind of petered out, and I think the spotlight moved and found someone else who,
yeah,
and they went, yes, it's them, it's not him, no, not him now,
okay,
them, and it might have been, maybe just maybe I mean just maybe I just wasn't well, very probably I just wasn't good enough for what they thought they needed in some of those things at that time, you know.
Do you think?
I don't know. Who knows?
That's one of the most annoying things. Is who knows? You don't know, do you?
Of course, you don't know.
You can beat yourself up.
Yeah.
Imagining if you want, well, they found someone better.
Yeah.
Or you can go, you know, realistically, TV people are really, really fickle.
Who knows? Exactly.
And something else turns up, their head gets turned, so, and they go, oh, actually, everyone's doing this, let's do this.
Yeah.
There's no reflection on you, so you might as well try and
stay. It's quite a reactive business, most of it. 95% of it is utterly reactive and not proactive and is uncreative, I think. So when we did the Friday Night Project, Channel 4 just really wanted to have a lady in the cast of the presenters as well, and that's when Sharon came to the audition, and I worked with her on a thing we'd done called The Pilot Show. So I said, look, fuck it, I had a fair crack of the whip.
Yeah, man.
Fuck it, I'm not whinging. And I really got on with Sharon. She's great fun, she's very funny, she's brilliant, as we all know, really talented. And we all did that, and I think ultimately we just too many people trying to do the same thing. So probably Channel 4, I imagine, looked at it and went, ah, "It's getting too complicated."
Yeah.
Out it all goes, and let's rebrand the whole thing.
Yeah.
But it's difficult not to be disappointed when things you feel they're going your way, and then it changes. That's human nature, isn't it?
Sure.
And I think, yeah, it took me a while to come to terms with that, because you're aware that the public is starting to go, "Oh, it's that guy." You're that guy at gigs and stuff.
Yes,
and you think, oh,
yes.
I could be playing to thousands here. I could be that tour I've just done could have been 1,000 seats. You know, I could be, you know, doing all this stuff. But it's all conjecture. It's all conjecture. And I think for a while it fucked with my head.
You seem to have come to terms with it.
Yeah,
now.
Yeah. And it made me unhappy. It definitely made me unhappy. And there was other stuff that I can't really go into with family and things and quite wider issues not wider issues, but kind of personal things with family and stuff that were kind of involved, and it became apparent to me that I probably was starting to get quite depressed.
Hmm.
I think that's what it was. It felt like I wasn't really kind of enjoying the ups and downs of life.
Yeah,
I just felt I was kind of letterboxing the whole thing out, without going into too much detail, there's a history, I think, in my family of things that people have not grown up in a world where you can really talk about it or deal with it.
Yeah,
essentially. And the other extreme is that kind of American thing that kind of, hey, everyone's seen their therapist and it's a comedy guy. I think it's too talked about, maybe.
Yeah.
I don't know. Fuck it. Who can judge? That's what you learn about life. So I thought I needed to sort my head out. So I kind of started to kind of go to see this guy and just got some help, because I realised that it was fucking up my relationship with Helen, my now wife,
yeah,
who I've got two kids with, and I'm happy to say I'm still with, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And it stuck by me.
Do you think that was, so there was the family stuff, which obviously we won't go into, but
yeah,
that was sort of happening at the same time as you were kind of going, hang on, there is a wobble here.
Yeah, exactly. I was thinking, what's going on, what's happening? Oh, and here come a load of problems at the same time. And it's just grown up life, isn't it? You either knocks you over and you don't get back up, or it fucks you up forever, or you try and, you know, you're lucky you've got the resources somehow to kind of sort it out, and I didn't end up on drugs or booze or try and turn it into something else, and what I think enabled me to do that was having mates, proper mates, outside of work and outside of comedy and everything, that were really kind of supportive and non-judgmental, but kind of held up a good mirror to maybe how I was, little bits of me.
It's crazy, I think, like we were saying before about not knowing why people might have gone cold on you, TV-wise. Not knowing, you'll never know. In much the same way as you don't often know, like we've all seen someone do a stand-up gig where, and during it, we'll go, they're losing them because they are not aware that they're talking to someone that's already been spoken to.
Yeah.
And like on the outside, you can see it, but they're up there now, they have no idea, and you can all see why it's going wrong.
He's
going
to tread on the mine!
Exactly. But when you're in that position yourself and you get this sense of this isn't working and you don't feel in control of it. And I think at the same time, stand-up should be something, or can be something, that is a party. That it's a walk in the park. It's like being a, you know, it's not a walk in the park, it's not necessarily easy, but it can be enjoyable and it can be exciting and make you feel like, as we should, feel like we're artists who also get to earn money from our art.
Yeah.
And that's like, who gets to do that, man? Actors, but they don't get to work.
Yeah.
You know, and painters, but they don't get to make money.
Mm.
It could be this kind of the glorious kind of crucible of excitement and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
But at the same time, because you have so little control, it can feel very fraught.
Yes.
And I think something that you seem to have done is you seem to have wrested back control of it. And you feel like you've got it by the throat and that you're doing it on your own terms.
It's always a balance between thinking you've got that and thinking you haven't. But I think, interestingly, throughout the whole thing, stand-up has been a backbone to all of it. It's been a constant. It's been a good friend to me, you know, in that regard. It's been consistent, because if you keep writing, if you keep improving and you keep working, you will get gigs.
Yeah. Well, that's something that Sarah was saying. It is
meritocratic.
Yeah. But success isn't necessarily meritocratic.
Exactly.
But being good at the work is.
Yeah, the big amplifier isn't necessarily. But then there are also the factors in how much you want to work, how much of your life you want to spend working, how much do you want to put into it, how much can you put into it, all those things. And then there's luck as well. But it's that we all know people who are very near or at the top of the pyramid of as you perceive it, but it's all perception. It's all
I'm sure they perceive themselves as being at one of the far corners of a much bigger pyramid.
Of course, exactly. Yeah. Thinking, well, there's Jerry Seinfeld up there.
Yeah,
exactly. And it's so I think, but certainly I found that was really, really, really useful, kind of, because it made me address kind of, it just made me try and find a bit more balance in my life, and I was terrified about kind of had this kind of, well, that my family that's there now was all, you know, was all on a plate. I think also at the same time, like my wife's a bit younger than me, partially to say, cash back. And I'm 38 now, Helen's 32, 10 years, so I was 28 when I met her. And she was 22 then, obviously. And then we were together about 3 years, and Helen went, right, I'm ready to, right, kids, what's happening? What are we doing here? Is this a goer? What's happening? Is this relationship going somewhere? Are we doing this or what? I know my initial reaction was, well, you're far too young to have children, you're only 25, how do you know? This is London, this is the media business. No one has children until they're in their late 40s, early 50s. And I just kind of, so there was that as well. So I was trying to work out, so what's happened here with this aspect of career or whatever, Then there's these things, other wider issues with you know, kind of emotional issues with family trying to sort out. Mm. And there's this thing here. And I couldn't work out any of it. And I just felt like I was going through the same thoughts, trying to sort it out.
Yeah.
But also I do think unless you are sort of, unless you stay aware and present in what you're doing, being a comedian will take a toll on you.
Yeah.
Emotionally, it's going to, because it's not a normal thing for a human being to do, to stand in front of loads of people with the express intention of making them laugh.
Yeah.
And your feelings of worth and everything riding on how well that goes.
Yeah.
And however many you do, however you try and look at it, that's you can't run away from that reality.
Sure. You come off, there's the elation, I did it this time, the elation wears off, I have to do it again.
And yeah, exactly. And there is also the physical aspect of that your adrenal kind of the toll on your adrenal system, and I think there's cortisol, there's something else I think that balances out your adrenaline or something. You can burn yourself out, and you can fry chips in your head, and that's why people end up either stopping doing stand up as they get older, or they get angry, or they have to or booze or drugs just consumes them, or they kind of they keep going and keep enjoying it. I think because it's like anything. Like I think every human being as well, whatever their career or choice or path, will have that kind of uncertainty or what was this all about? Because that's inevitability of realizing you're on the back nine of your life potentially, or you're turning the corner of that and just thinking, what the fuck was all this about? What's left?
Yeah,
you know, it's God, we've gone deep, Stu. What's happening? I think I might.
Don't pull back.
I'm not going to pull back.
Stay deep.
I know you're right. I'll stay deep. I'll stay in it. I'm going to stay in it. But I think that's what it is. Yes, life is complicated, and stand up is not a normal thing to do.
Yeah.
So those two things, the confluence of those two things, potentially can cause people trouble, I think.
Yeah.
So that sorting all that out, sorting that out. I never felt I'd sorted it out, but just gradually over time, I started. I maybe just letting the pressure off myself.
Yeah.
Sort of beating myself up about it. Stop thinking that it should have been another way, or it should be this way round, or whatever.
Yeah.
And then just looked at what was in front of me and realised I was a very, very lucky man. You spend a lot of time on your own doing this job as well.
Yeah.
Just wait, or potentially waiting for stuff, you know?
Yeah.
And that's not a healthy thing to do. To wait, to mark time, is it?
No.
Do stuff. Go and do things, or take stuff to do while you're there. And then, so when you're at home, you can just have downtime or just be with your friends or do others, just not work.
Yes.
Free time.
Yes. Do you have any strategies for that in particular? I mean, a lot of this show, I realise now, having a bunch of episodes, is basically me saying, how do you cope? Let's specifically talk about coping with that, about the fact that stand-up is upside down. You're free during the day, then you have to work. So you can't relax during the day because you haven't worked yet. And then you work, and then you can relax, and then you've got to go to bed.
Yeah.
So what sorts of strategies do you have? How do you live your life around stand-up? What sorts of things you do that
make it easier? Constantly under review.
Yeah.
And it would be fascinating. I mean, it would also be fair, I think. I mean, if it would be fair if Helen was here to give you the her side of it.
I'm going
to
do a special. I'm going to do a special.
Come and
wax.
Do it. Come and do it. I'll put this out. Because she would always say that, I'm very bad at switching off, all that kind of stuff. And in my head, I'm some kind of utopian. Hey, I've got it. I'm living in the moment. This is fine. I've got it all worked out. It's all groovy. But she go, you're a fucking egg case.
Yeah.
You're doing my nutting.
Yeah.
And it's easier when you're not here.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. So I go away for a few days and do gigs. And that's a truth, right?
Yeah.
Helen finds it easier to look after the kids and do all that and deal with it and cope with it without me there. And when I come back, I have to find my way back into my home life.
Okay, and
I've been on tour for the best part of 3 months.
Yeah,
and now it's winding down for Christmas. I feel like I'm I'm more in the home because she feels I'm actually there. I was in and out a lot, but I was never really there. And it's accepting that that is actually the fact rather than my own narrative that I kind of create that as how I think it is. The flip side of being working nights is I've spent a lot of time with my kids on the floor with them as they're growing up, which Brilliant. Is immense. It's yeah. awesome.
Yeah.
And there's other times when you end up working days and nights as well. And as I get older, I find that I can't work all day, then do a gig at night unless I have a sleep. But likewise, I'll expend as more energy in a day with the kids and then go and do a gig at night. So I need a kip after that. Otherwise, and that meant often on tour, me leaving half an hour earlier than I needed to leave and then sleeping in a fucking car park. My car, just putting my earplugs in, getting the heaters on, put the seat back, and having a kip like a tramp with facilities.
Yeah.
That's how I look at it. But that was crucial because it allows me to reset my brain and then I can, then I wake up again and I can sparkle and do it. No gigs make or break, that's it.
This isn't
make or break.
Yeah, none of it. No one gig is make or break. That's really good advice.
I wish I'd follow that.
It feels like it's not true. Yeah. I can imagine myself listening to that a year in and thinking, yeah, but apart from this one, I've got this really important. Yeah. And it's not. None of them. If you're going to do this forever, none of them are.
Yeah, yeah. Or the one that seems like this is the one that my career hinges on. No, it doesn't.
Yeah.
Or if it doesn't go your way, fuck it. It's your life. Don't let it ruin your life.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, then you'll have nothing to bring back to the next one, I think. I think it's because I've been doing it 14 years. I've had a few kind of ups and downs within that I perceive. You just don't let it become more important than your life. Because then you'll stop. Then you'll stop doing it well. Or at least that's how I look at it. I'll stop enjoying it. And then it won't mean you can fall in and out of love with it as well. That's another thing, I think, over time. I had a period where I just kind of, I think I was just knackered, and I thought I'm not really enjoying this. So I took a month off, and then just did some other stuff, wrote some stuff, had a really nice time, caught up with friends that I needed to see.
Yeah.
Drank a lot, and then went back and did it again, and was really enjoying it again. Because I just realised, I've not really had a break from this in 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
Christ's sake, just relax a bit, enjoy it. It's simple, but it's a metaphor for life, isn't it? Just enjoy all of it, enjoy it, it ain't make or break, don't try and think there's a formula and do it. That's what I'd say to new comics, really, just shit or bust, go for it, just do it, because now when you're starting, that's the time to really go for it and just be as weird as you want, and then also don't be afraid to change. You don't have to do it all the same way.
That's really good advice. Don't be afraid to change, I think, is excellent advice, because I think I've certainly felt a pressure that I put on myself. I found a thing here, I have to do that thing, and I'll be letting people down if I don't do that thing. And as a dear friend of mine once suggested, No one will notice or even care. this is all in your head.
Yeah.
So change
it. David Bowie changed all the time, didn't he? He's a spaceman, he's a lady, he's a man, he's with Mick Jagger, what's going on? Mumford and Sons, they bring out their Distressed Furniture, very popular first album.
Yeah.
Think, what they're going to do next time? Yeah, got the waistcoats back on again.
More of
the same, just keep changing it. I think that's really important. Change it up and don't be a square, for fuck's sake. If it's itchy, scratch it. Scratch the itchy bits. That's what you should do, isn't it? Because that's the bits that we need to, need to talk about. Like, look at some of the stuff that Tom Stade does, like the way where he thinks, this is where I'm going to start. It's brilliant. Bill Burr, have you seen Bill Burr's bit he does about Steve Jobs?
No, never seen it.
Everyone listening to this, go into YouTube and look at Night of Too Many Stars, Bill Burr, B-I-L-L-B-U-R-R. He does a great podcast, Monday Morning Podcast.
Yes, yeah, I've heard of it.
Brilliant. Yeah. But basically, he does a routine about Steve Jobs. Yeah, I don't really see what that guy did. Do you know, I'm not even going to try to describe it, but it's great. He does it at this massive media charity event where everyone, you know, like all of us, has got an iPhone, an Apple, an Apple computer. We're all slaves to this world where we know that Apple's going to be a fucking bank in 10 years. It's got all our details. They don't give much away to tax, you know what I mean, but we kind of overlook them. We'll boycott Starbucks, but use our iPhones in our independent coffee shop. Exactly. And it's comfy, it's in my pocket. It's made out of glass. Why did he make it out of fucking glass? But and it's just remarkable. You can see him have to really push this routine over the cliff to get them to laugh at the thing that's just a bit too close to be comfortable.
Yes.
And it is fucking amazing. And they love it by the end of it. But he's just, it's just awesome. He rips into kind of, he's so charming as well, and about geeks and stuff. And like, when did the geek guy become the kind of, so looking at what's the sacred cow, what we have a movement now, it's all about kind of anyway, yeah, I've read a few books, deal with it. Anything like that, I find that kind of irks me. Anything where people are kind of they're trying to play the tribe first before the funnies.
Okay
Do you know what I mean?
Where you're trying to go,
we're all the same thing, let's get in, you're on my choir, and sing a little song. It doesn't have to be that good a song because you've already established you're in a choir.
Yes.
It's much more interesting to watch people
try and win over people.
Yes. To try and challenge them at the outset, whether it's by being slightly confrontational but still warm and human about it, or whether they're just being off beam and just doing the thing that they love doing, like Dr. Brown, like his shows are phenomenal, aren't they? And the more I do it, the more I think it's about doing whatever it is you do, whatever style or however unboxable thing that you do is, it's about being utterly unapologetic for what you're doing, isn't it? It's about being completely... So you're giving off that energy that this is all it's going to be.
This is it.
This is it. Yeah. This is all. Yeah. This is what I'm going to do. This is what I'm going to do.
Mm.
It's funny. It was good actually. Having done that first show about my family and kind of being aware that there was a bit of that kind of, oh, this is a bit, I've heard about kids.
Yeah.
I think it was about 2010. I found through links looking on YouTube Louis CK.
Yeah.
And obviously, you know, I think it's remarkable. And through him, I found Bill Burr and other American comics. And it just kind of vilified means.
I think vindicated.
Vindicated. Thank you, Stu. I am actually an idiot under all of this, but I only studied that much at school. Just enough. I knew how to pass exams. That's what it was. But it vindicated that I thought, oh, I'm going to stop worrying about any of this now.
Yeah.
Because yes, he's doing stuff about kids. It's totally different from what I'm talking about. It's just a life experience, and it's your own story each time. But it was inspiring. Going, wow, and he is so good. He's been doing it 20 odd years. He's so relaxed on stage.
Yeah, he's someone who can approach a topic that someone could lazily describe as a hack topic, and make you realise just how much there is still to find in it.
Absolutely.
And how awful it is to consider something hack.
Totally. And that's what Bill Burr does with that Steve Jobs routine.
Mm.
It's great. And I'm kind of excited about thinking if I just to stay happy and stay content, or at least not, you know, you won't always be happy, but to stay honest to what, try and do it in a way that kind of feels like it's just still just me, and I'm not having to try and be someone else. And then and then sort of warm up kind of came a little bit full circle in a way that I ended up being the regular warm up on 8 out of 10 Cats, which was the show I was doing when the duck was killed. But also 8 out of 10 Cats was a show that I'd been on 3 times at the start of the series.
Sure.
But this was post Friday Night Projects and Channel 4 things, when I was on Channel, or I'd been on some Channel 4 things. And it was a weird moment in my life in terms of taking the job, because there was a bit of me going, I don't know whether I feel right doing this. Yeah. And another bit of me kind of going, the money's handy if you want to go to Edinburgh. and do and develop what you're doing.
That is such a choice to have to make, isn't it?
And I kind of thought, and I thought, actually, the only thing that's getting in the way of me doing this and banking this decent check that enables gives me more creative freedom is my ego. That's the only thing. It's my just got to get over myself and do it.
To go back and do the warm up for a show that you've appeared on.
Yeah.
That is hard. That's
I appeared on it.
So you did it. I appeared on it.
I think once or twice in my own right, and either once or twice I was booked in the warm up when the 7/7 bombings happened.
Right.
And ended up doing a recording of the show with we did with just the production team in the front chairs, at the white chairs, and then the audience at the back was empty. It was nuts, but
was that transmitted?
Yeah, it was. And I think there was some audience in there, and they obviously kind of did something with the sound, as I imagine.
And they were down an act, so you stepped in.
Yeah, Richard Mayer couldn't come.
Okay.
So doing a warm up on a show that I had been on, and probably thought I should be being on this one.
Yeah,
and I felt I'd been around that circle once. And it is weird, Stu, because you kind of it's a very small world, isn't it? All of it. It's a very small world, and I kind of I felt I had to make a decision. Yeah, I thought, well, if I'm doing Edinburgh, then I'm going to be fucking skint. So I need to earn more than I'm just going to earn.
And
just
so what?
Regular gigs.
That's like, man, that's like something in a movie. You've got to make this choice. Yeah. You've got to make the choice because, and you, if you went back and did it and you took the money in order to do the creative thing, that's the right choice. But I don't know if I could have made that choice. I think my ego would have prevented me. And not in a sort of bullshit ego way, but in a, I mean, something we haven't really talked about warm up is how thankless it can be and how much you can feel like, if it goes wrong, you can feel like you can get the blame. And if it goes well, then it just looks like the show was great.
Yeah.
You know, and people do. Producers go, oh, thanks, mate. Great job. But, you know, there's nothing more soul-destroying than being in the middle of a good warm-up bit in a break in recording.
Yeah.
And you're rocking it. And then they go, okay, thanks, in the middle of a bit. And it's back to, oh, you know, the people are looking past you to try and see the famous people.
Yeah.
That is a big sort of emotional and struggle, I think. Yeah. I think that's one of the reasons Patrick Monaghan's so good at it, apart from his skill set, is he doesn't care about stuff like that. He doesn't have that ego in that sort of way. Mm. So he's like, boom, back to this. For you and me, certainly for me, and I imagine for you as well, being on stage but not being the person on stage, being in this weird limbo between the two where you've got them and then you have to give them away in the middle of...
Yeah.
Your thing. It's like having sex with someone and then getting tapped on the shoulder. Well, you'd finish now, wouldn't you? So, you know,
wow. It's mad, isn't it? It's mad.
So
it's all ego stuff, isn't it?
Yeah, but with that in mind, to go back on, how did it feel like to do when you walked on and you knew that the people on the panel in the show knew that you'd been on it? Did you feel there was any... not antipathy, but did you imagine any sort of, like, they'd be looking down on you for going back?
I probably went through all those permutations in my head. Yeah, but I ended up squaring it with myself that I do, because they were always on Wednesday or Thursday nights, and I was living in London at the time, so I could go and do a fun gig in London, a creative gig afterwards.
Yeah.
So I had a thing in my head. I said, I'll do one for the bank, one for the soul.
Yeah.
That's how I looked at it. And that's exactly how I looked at it. So I couldn't do that. It was a bank raid. But I'd also think if I'm doing a warm up, fuck it, I'll do some stuff that I have to do.
Yeah.
And then I'm gonna do some newer stuff.
Yeah.
Just do it as a gig and then just get out and if I can.
Well done.
And then I started doing quite a few of them. And then there just came a point where I just kind of thought, right, I'm gonna knock it on the head now.
Yeah.
So I've done enough. And I'd started writing my own scripts, and I thought, it's all perception, ego, fear, worry, thinking, well, they'll only think of me as that.
Well, that is...
But then also...
Not to say that isn't true. There is a danger that they only think of you as a warm-up guy. Yeah.
But it was through doing the warm-up that I got some jobs on the...
Yeah.
In the first place. So it's really kind of complicated. And I think just talking to Helen and stuff, she just went, stop, it doesn't fucking matter.
Mm.
You're thinking about this too much. Or if you don't want to do it, don't do it. But it doesn't... Fuck it. You know, I think that's what it comes down to. Your life is bigger than all of that. And if your life becomes that world, or how you feel you fit into that or don't fit into that, or where you fit into that world, it's a recipe for disaster.
Yeah,
it's not good. Good for your health.
The one thing that can save you really is the work. You have to try and forget all of those things and go, this is an audience and I will stand there and do stuff, and whoever's standing behind me doesn't matter.
Yeah,
and whatever I've done before this or will do after it, that doesn't matter. Yeah. There's me and there's an audience, and that, if you kind of focus on the purity of that experience, then that will get you through it.
Yeah,
that, you know, also, that's what it's about.
I've got a family to feed.
Yeah.
It's a bit kind of, I've got a wife and two kids to feed.
Sure, man, sure.
But it's about, I've got a family to feed.
Well, this is like Alan was saying as well, but it's almost the opposite side of the true sentiment of play the room, not the occasion.
Yeah.
You just have to go and play the room.
It's
the negative version of that. Rather than the occasion being something special, the occasion is something less than special that might make you feel a bit crumpled.
Yeah.
You've got to do the work. You've made the decision to do the work for your family, for your creative life. Dude, play the room.
Yeah, it's like, I imagine most people who do corporate gigs, they probably hate the majority of them.
Sure,
because the audience, you know, they're works doers, and you know, there's a massive dance floor between them and the audience or whatever. There's a myriad of reasons why there could be hard work.
And I tell you, the other way you can not enjoy corporate is if you do it really well and you come away from it thinking, well, I'm the sort of guy that does really well.
Yeah, you're always going to find a reason to beat yourself up, aren't you?
Of course.
If you choose to be that way around, that's the thing, isn't it? Yeah.
So that was Rob. What an incredibly lovely man. He's one of those people. Listening back to that conversation whilst editing it, I'm just struck by what a warm and generous and lovely man Rob is. I really am very proud to call him my friend. Next week, I'm going to be talking to James Acaster. That's our live special that I'm recording very soon in the next couple of days, and that'll be out next week. So thanks to Rob. Thanks to all the usual suspects. I will speak to you. Oh, thank you and hello to Richard van Bilzen at Zwartkat in the Netherlands. Hello, guys. And thank you to everybody at the Edinburgh Stand for such a bloody lovely weekend. James Acaster next week. I will speak to you then. Thanks for listening.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend. Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt. So throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.